Thank you for downloading Business Matters live on the BBC World Service 5 days a week at 8 a.m. Singapore time and 8 p.m. New York time.
It's midnight GMT. Hello, I'm Alex Ritson, and this is Business Matters on the BBC World Service. In America, the working day is winding down, but in Asia, it's the start of another day. We're connecting the time zones, and today we're live in Massachusetts and Singapore. The former president of Switzerland has been giving Britain advice on how to get a trade deal with Europe that doesn't involve free movement of people.
For the time being, I'm sure that for Switzerland, the Brexit opens new ways.
Abuja, the capital of Nigeria, has set its sights on becoming the Silicon Valley for the continent of Africa. And as the new edition of the Guinness Book of Records is published, I get a personal lesson in hula hooping from the world record holder, Marua the Amazing. That's Business Matters here on the BBC. But first, the latest BBC news.
This is the BBC News. Hello, I'm Jonathan Izard. The French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve says three women have been detained on suspicion of planning imminent terror attacks after a car packed with gas canisters was found in central Paris. Mr. Cazeneuve said one of the women was shot when she attacked police officers with a knife as they tried to arrest her in a town outside Paris.
The operation led to the arrests of three people, three young women, in connection with the discovery of a car containing gas canisters over the weekend in Paris. These three women, aged 39, 23 and 19, had been radicalized, were fanatics, and were, in all likelihood, preparing an imminent violent act. The actions of the police mean that our country has avoided another tragedy.
A total of seven people are now being held by police in connection with the case. France is on high alert after a string of deadly Islamist attacks. Brazilian police say they want to speak to the president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, in connection with an alleged illegal ticketing scheme during last month's Rio Games. The police say he's being treated as a witness, not a suspect. Wera Davis reports.
Police investigators in Rio said the IOC president received personal requests for hundreds of high-value tickets for the Olympics opening ceremony, the 100 metres final and the football final, from Patrick Hickey, the head of the Irish Olympic Committee. Prosecutors here have accused Mr. Hickey of being at the centre of a multi-million dollar scheme to illegally sell Olympic tickets on the black market. Police say that 71-year-old Mr. Hickey, who was arrested in Rio last month and has denied the allegations, received 296 tickets after his written request to the IOC president.
Brazil has won some of the first medals at the Rio Paralympics. It's taken gold in the men's long jump and silver in the men's 5,000 metres. China is leading the medals table, followed by Britain. Reports say a senior commander of one of the most powerful Islamist rebel groups in Syria has been killed in an airstrike. The Fateh al-Sham group, previously known as the Nusra Front, said the commander, Abu Omar Sarakeb, was killed in Aleppo province. 45 people are spending the night stranded inside cable cars at an altitude of more than 3,000 metres over the Mont Blanc Massif in the Alps. 110 people were initially trapped when the system ground to a halt, but 65 have been evacuated by helicopter. Frédéric was one of those rescued.
The last hour seemed to last forever. We didn't have any information, so we called a company and they explained to us that three cables got entangled and they couldn't disentangle all of them. And because it was taking too long, they decided to evacuate the cabins. Because there was a lot of people involved, they did it by helicopter. It was really scary, really difficult up there.
You're listening to the World News from the BBC. The Pentagon has revealed that US forces in Afghanistan carried out a failed attempt to rescue two hostages last month. A spokesman said a number of hostile forces were killed, but the hostages were not at the location. He said no US service personnel or civilians were harmed. A study into the genetic makeup of giraffes has discovered that there are four different species of the mammal and not just one. A 40% decline in the population of wild giraffes in the last 15 years prompted the research, as Victoria Gill reports.
Scientists sampled giraffe DNA to find out more about their fragmented population. This revealed that there are four separate species of giraffe: the reticulated, the northern, the southern, and the Maasai giraffe. Searching their genetic code, the scientists found evidence that at some point in the last 2 million years of evolution, giraffes stopped interbreeding and naturally separated into different species, as genetically distinct as a brown bear is from a polar bear. So looking deep into their DNA could show conservationists exactly what these animals need from their environment to help protect the habitat that these huge but graceful creatures rely on.
NASA has launched a space probe to collect dust from an asteroid named Bennu, a big black rock orbiting the sun. The probe is scheduled to arrive in August 2018 and return to Earth 5 years later. It's the first time a spacecraft has been sent to gather dust and debris from an asteroid. And one of the pioneers of ska music, the Jamaican singer Prince Buster, has died at his home in Florida. He was 78. Born Cecil Bustamante Campbell on Orange Street in the capital Kingston, he went on to record classics such as One Step Beyond, Al Capone and Madness.
Madness, madness, they call it madness.
His recordings in the early 1960s inspired a revival of ska music in Britain 2 decades later, with bands including Madness and The Specials covering his songs. BBC News.
Hello and welcome to Business Matters. I'm Alex Ritson. On the programme today, Switzerland's former president, Michelin Calmiere, says Britain should work with her country to negotiate a new trade deal with Europe with a different approach to free movement of people. British comedian Stephen Fry says Apple should pay more tax, but economist Erwin Stelzer disagrees.
Everybody agrees that people should pay the right rate of tax. But everybody here thinks there's just a bit of a dash of anti-Americanism in what the European Union wants to do.
And how dedication, practice and self-belief are the ingredients of entrepreneurship, yes, but also becoming the world record holder in the noble art of hula hooping. I'll be joined throughout the programme by two guests on opposite sides of the Pacific. Richard Wolff is Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts and founder of Democracy at Work, and David Kuo of the financial website The Motley Fool. He's in Singapore. There will be a price to pay if the UK wants to stay in the EU's free trade area post-Brexit. Senior figures have made it pretty clear that the right to buy and sell goods without facing tariffs will depend on allowing fellow Europeans to come and go as they please. And that includes giving Britain's European neighbours the freedom to live and work in the UK. Switzerland isn't in the EU. Currently, it enjoys free trade and open borders. But 2 years ago, Swiss citizens rejected continuing free movement of people in a referendum. Our economics editor Kamal Ahmed reports from Switzerland on the lessons it may have for Britain.
I'm in Cours de Saint-Pierre, in the beautiful old quarter of Geneva, a city square that frankly hasn't changed much in several hundred years. Politically here in Switzerland, there is no such stability, particularly when it comes to this country's relationship with its all-encompassing neighbour, the European Union. 2 years ago, this country voted in a referendum to halt the free movement of people, part of its trade agreement with the EU. And since then, frankly, nothing much has happened. The European Union has been unwilling to negotiate on the issue of border controls. Free movement is one of its 4 founding principles. If a country in Europe wants preferential access to the single market, and Switzerland has more than 130 free trade agreements with the EU, open borders is part of the deal. But with Brexit approaching, there are now calls for the UK to work with Switzerland, encouraging the EU to soften its position for countries in Europe but not in the Union.
My name is Michelin Calmiere. I was president and foreign minister of Switzerland.
Michelin Calmiere knows all about negotiating with the EU, leading many Swiss government delegations to Brussels. She says Brexit could start pushing the EU towards a more flexible approach.
I think it would be a good thing. We could collaborate. For the time being, I'm sure that for Switzerland, the Brexit opens new ways, quite new situation. We had difficulties in negotiating with the European Union. Great Britain is a big and important country, and the European Union has no interest to let Great Britain go towards America and Asia, I don't know where.
I'm on the early morning train from Geneva to Zurich, passing Lac Le Mans in glorious sunshine. The country was split in the 2014 vote. Urban areas with higher levels of immigration tended to vote against quotas. Rural areas with less immigration tended to vote for controls on freedom of movement. I'm about to meet the man seen as the authority in Switzerland on negotiating with the EU.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now arriving at the Zurich main station on platform number 16.
Michael Ambuhl, I was State Secretary in the Ministry of Finance and earlier State Secretary in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Professor Michael Ambuhl negotiated many of Switzerland's agreements with the EU and is now a Professor of Negotiation at the ETH University in Zurich. This trade deal expert believes the EU will need to change from its present wholly in or wholly out approach.
I think the basic problem is what I call the binary problem. You are either fully in or you're fully out. This does not serve the interest, I think, neither of the European Union nor of the outsiders. I'm sure that Brexit is sort of a catalyzer for contributing to the debate whether the European Union has to become a bit more flexible vis-à-vis European countries not being member of the European Union.
The question, would the EU really want to create a third way on free movement? That could be controversial with the remaining EU members, as Chenny Nagy from Voraus, the Swiss foreign policy think tank, points out.
If the EU is too soft with the UK, other countries might also choose to exit. And this might be the end of EU integration as we know it now. They don't want the EU to implode, they don't want other countries to go out, and this is why they will have to be a little bit unbenevolent with the UK.
The bells are tolling on the issue of free movement, and time is running out for Switzerland, which needs a deal by next year. Its parliament is proposing maintaining free movement, but giving preference in the jobs market to Swiss citizens. It's just the latest attempt to solve the immigration single market conundrum, which will be at the heart of Britain's Brexit negotiations.
And that was our economics editor, Kamal Ahmed, reporting from Switzerland. Well, I'm joined by our guests on opposite sides of the Pacific, Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics at the University of Massachusetts, and David Kuo at the Motley Fool. Why is freedom of movement such an issue in the world today? Richard, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think there are several dimensions of why it's so important. One is obviously key for Europe. If you're going to become a unified market, a unified economic unit on the scale of the European Union and its plans, then you are duty-bound and logically driven to have freedom of movement of people, more or less, to use the example of the United States, the way we have freedom of movement from Texas to California or from New York to Chicago, etc., because it's part of what it means to have a unified economic system. To begin to make exceptions, whether they're for Britain or they're for Switzerland or anywhere else, as somebody said earlier in the program, really opens up a kind of Pandora's box in which not just the question of free movement, but all the other dimensions of a unified economic community become open to debate, and the process begins to spin out of control. Contrary to what a couple of the folks that you interviewed said, it seems to me that Switzerland was small enough that you might entertain some sort of super special situation for them because the impact there on the rest of the European Union is small. But in the case of Britain, it's much too important and much too large an economic unit to function in that way. So my guess is that rather than opening the opportunities for Switzerland, the Brexit event will actually close the chances they might have had on the grounds of their smallness to perhaps get an exception.
David Kuo, do you agree? And I guess the underlying question is this racism?
Well, I don't think it is racism, Alex. You know, I'm a great believer in open borders. In other words, you know, I believe that a country should open up its borders so that there is a free movement of people both in and out. And that is one way in which you can actually transfer skills from one country to another. But just because you open the borders doesn't actually mean that the people who come into a particular country can access all the benefits and all the services that the people of that country are entitled to. So here in Singapore, for instance, I wouldn't say we have open borders, but people are allowed to actually work here in Singapore. Now, when they come to Singapore, they don't get access to things like the health service here. They will have to actually pay for it. And I think, you know, this is really the sticking point between Europe and the UK, for instance. People from Europe would like to work in the UK, and similarly, the people in the UK would like to work in Europe. But just because you come to the UK doesn't mean that you will be entitled to the social benefits, the unemployment benefits, the housing benefits, the health service benefits. And I think, you know, that is where the negotiations can take place. But I think Britain would be a far worse place if they close their borders and don't allow people from Europe, not only Europe, but from the rest of the world into the UK.
I suppose underlying what you're both saying is that there are people in Europe who would like to see a United States of Europe, and if the EU gives way on this, as many people would say it, fundamental principle, a United States of Europe would never happen.
Yes, I'm afraid that is my perspective, and I guess I would politely disagree that if you allowed foreigners to come into England, but they would not be able to access the public services, the National Health Service, et cetera, you would be creating what were in effect different levels of citizenship. We would all be equal, but some of us would be more equal than others. And if you remember that the workers who come in are often doing vital work, paying taxes when they buy goods and services, the justification for them not being given the very services their work and their tax payments finance would be a dangerous way of questioning the very democratic principles that
are
supposed to
apply here. But they are not the citizens of that country, though, Richard. They are not the citizens of that particular country.
But they are working in and paying taxes to that society. Why would that not entitle them to the services that other people's taxes and labor contribute to?
Because the other people have contributed over a long period of time towards that economy, and you can't allow somebody who just comes in through the front door today and then suddenly be entitled to all the benefits, you know, that people have contributed to over a long period of time.
But the people who contributed in the past received services in the past. The people who are coming now are doing the work and paying the taxes to receive the services now that their labor and their tax payments cover and pay for. It seems to me a hard thing to justify something that your parents did or your forebears did, what benefited them at that time, somehow creates the possibility for an inequality now.
I have to jump in and say there will be more argument later. You are with Business Matters from the BBC World Service. Let's get a reminder of the top headlines this hour from Jonathan.
The French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve says three women have been detained on suspicion of planning terror attacks after a car packed with gas canisters was found in central Paris. Brazilian police say they want to speak to the president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, in connection with an alleged illegal ticketing scheme during last month's Rio Games. They say he's being treated as a witness, not a suspect. And 45 people are spending the night stranded in cable cars at an altitude of more than 3,000 metres over the Mont Blanc Massif in the Alps. 65 others have been evacuated by helicopter. On financial markets, in Tokyo, the Nikkei 225 index was up 0.1 of a percentage point a short time ago at 16,840. And on the currency markets, $1 will buy you 102 Japanese yen.
You're listening to Business Matters on the BBC World Service. Coming up, more stories from around the globe, including, can Africa ever truly compete with Silicon Valley in the United States?
It is actually improving. A couple of years ago, it was nothing like this here. Now, we have over 10 co-working spaces here in Abuja.
And I get taught how to hula hoop in record time by the greatest hula hooper in the world today.
No panicking. Everybody panics and they get in there and they start going like this and they bend their knees and they do some big crazy circles with it. No panicking, you just breathe.
Some customers of the technology giant Apple are struggling to digest the company's decision to remove the traditional headphone jack from its latest smartphone. But its biggest challenge is not persuading us to embrace wireless headphones. It's got to deal with a $14.5 billion $1 billion back tax bill from the Republic of Ireland after the European Commission ruled it had benefited from illegal tax breaks. The company couldn't even escape the hugely controversial tax issue at its glitzy phone launch on Wednesday. Celebrity fan Stephen Fry had this to say on corporation tax.
Everybody should pay absolutely the rate of tax that is right. I mean, I obviously don't know every detail, but it seems they definitely should. I think it was Benjamin Franklin who said tax is the price we pay for civilization. And if people are not paying tax properly, then obviously civilization falters. Our streets don't get lit. There's more crime. There's more, you know, everything gets worse. So I have absolutely no patience with any of these large companies getting away with such minuscule rates of taxation.
Apple's tax bill is viewed very differently in Europe and in the United States. My colleague Rob Young spoke to Erwin Stelzer, an economist at the Hudson Institute in the US. He asked him what Americans are saying.
There are two feelings. Everybody agrees that people should pay the right rate of tax. But everybody here thinks there's just a bit of a dash of anti-Americanism in what the European Union wants to do. After all, they're not only suing people for taxes, they're suing them for their advertising techniques, they're suing American nationals for violating rules on copyright, they're suing them for privacy problems. So there is a feeling in the United States that there is something called Euro Envy. You guys don't have any famous digital companies. Zip zero. So we can't tell whether you would have treated your own and are just discriminating against Americans. But there's a feeling here that there is more than a little anti-Americanism in it. And that doesn't mean that's right. But that, you've asked me what people are talking about. That's what they're talking about.
So some people think that in the year 2014, Apple paying a rate of tax of 0.005% was the right amount of tax.
Well, but the right amount of tax is not set by Apple. The right amount of tax is set by the rules by which taxation is levied. And the problem with that is that the system is wrong. You have a system of international taxation where you're chasing the profits of these companies. They're very, very good at legally getting them into low-profit areas, into countries like Ireland and so on, where the tax rate is very low, until you get around to taxing them simply on the place where they make their sales. They will win this game and they will win it legally.
So you're advocating that companies pay a tax on the sales they make in every country rather than the profits they make in an individual country. But there have been efforts for years and years to try to reform the global system for corporation tax, and the talks have got nowhere. And so doesn't there need to be some kind of interim solution while politicians from around the world try to come up with a longer-term solution?
Well, I think yes, but I think now, because politicians are under terrible strain to get revenue, and they're not getting any, the tax system now is not giving them any revenue. So they would probably be more susceptible to something that is slightly less sophisticated, but at least produces some revenue. Now, if they don't want to do that, then there's no solution. Then Apple will continue to pay 0.5% or whatever it is in taxes, because that's their legal obligation.
When politicians are running for office, companies are getting their checkbooks out to pay for the lobbying of these politicians. It's not very likely that companies are going to be saying to the Trump or Clinton camps that they would like some kind of sales tax imposed upon them rather than the system they have at the moment, is it?
Oh, no, they're not going to say they would like it. Now, it's Mrs. Clinton, Secretary Clinton, who's financed by these companies. The companies in Silicon Valley are prodigious givers to the Clinton campaign and give nothing to the Trump campaign. So she would be more beholden to them if she is elected. Now, I think what's going to happen here, and in fact, I'm relatively sure what's going to happen here, is that there will be a lowering of the corporate tax rate of 35% to something closer to 20, which would allow American companies to bring home a lot of these profits, and they would be subject to American taxation, which would then end a good part of the problem.
Erwin Stelzer talking to the BBC's Rob Young. Let's go to Nigeria, where the city of Lagos has for years been the main hub for technology startups in the country. But recently, more tech businesses have been moving to the capital, Abuja. Now there are plans to build Nigeria's very own Silicon Valley. There are hopes it'll become a hub not just for tech firms from Nigeria, but for companies from across the whole of Africa. The BBC's Ijoma Ndukwe reports.
This is the reception, and then we have the cafe. There you could get drinks and all that. You could get drinks from that point.
A tour of Ventures platform. It's a new hub in Abuja for technology startups, where selected businesses are supported and nurtured over a four-month period. The heart of Nigeria's technology ecosystem has traditionally been in Lagos, but this space is one of many springing up and filling a void for technology startups in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Kola Aino co-founded Ventures Platform. He's been in the technology space for over 6 years.
There was the basics of an ecosystem, but how developed was it? That's a whole other question. I had personally played a part in, you know, speaking and mentoring and just talking with startups. And so we started engaging and trying to understand where the gaps were in the ecosystem. And we realized that it wasn't just a funding gap. It was really about providing startups the mentorship, the workspace, the support services, and the right kind of environment to really build great companies and scale these companies into sustainable ventures.
Startups come together here in Ventures co-working space. In this large open-plan office, around a dozen people are sitting in small groups, chatting or typing away at their laptops. Timmy Ayemo is the co-founder of MobiDoc. It's an app which connects people to doctors via chat room for real-time health consultations.
What is wrong? I've been in the tech space for over 16 years now. So I can say emphatically that it is actually improving. I mean, a couple of years ago, it was nothing like this here. But now we have over 10 co-working spaces here in Abuja. Probably even more than that. And they just keep coming up. We're still not at the scale of Lagos, but yes, things are actually improving here in Abuja.
A short drive from Abuja Airport, a new government venture is in construction. It's the Abuja Technology Village, also known as ATV and Free Trade Zone. It aims to place Abuja as the leading destination for technology firms and startups in West Africa. I'm standing by the road looking out at the site of the Abuja Technology Village, around 25 kilometres from the international airport. At the moment, there are no buildings here, but nearly 80% of basic infrastructure has been put in place, including roads, street lamps, electricity and fibre optic cables. They hope to attract companies ranging from big international tech firms to domestic startups. But with the current economic difficulties in Nigeria, there's a lot of uncertainty about how many companies will want to move in.
Hello, Anna. Hi, good evening. How are you?
Michael Oluwabemi co-founded the company Afrilabs, which connects technology hubs throughout the continent to create a pan-African infrastructure. The technology entrepreneur has concerns about whether ATV will be pulled off successfully.
It's always been in the plans, and I believe the plans are elaborate, but it's always the devil is always in the details and in the implementation here in Africa, in Nigeria especially. You have the inefficiencies of the procurement process and the inability to properly plan and implement projects. The ATV had its lofty plan, but it's yet to live up to its best ideals. But we hope that some form of reform that is ongoing across the government of today will eventually get to the ATV.
Notion that competition isn't healthy because it gives you anxiety and panic attack and all this other stuff. You know who's that been said by? You know who says things like that? People who lost.
At a startup workshop in Abuja, a motivational video is played to inspire the room filled with techpreneurs. Key players in Abuja are working to transform the city into a destination for tech firms. But with many other African cities vying for the top spot and a lot of catching up to do, its future as one of Africa's leading technology hubs remains uncertain.
The BBC's Ijoma Ndukwe. I have plenty more from our guests on opposite sides of the Pacific over the next half hour. Richard Wolff, professor at the University of Massachusetts, and David Kuo at the Motley Fool in Singapore. Welcome back to Business Matters with me, Alex Ritson. Let's go straight to our guests on opposite sides of the Pacific. Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts, and David Kuo at the Motley Fool website in Singapore. Richard Wolff, it's the first time you've been with us on the programme, and I was fascinated when I was reading your biography. You describe yourself as a Marxist. What does that mean today?
Well, here in the United States, as you probably know, for most of the last half century, it has been virtually impossible for someone to run for office or even to get a university job if he or she had such a label. The reason I accept it is, first, that I have learned a great deal from the writings of Karl Marx and from the Marxist tradition thereafter. But since I've learned from other traditions just as well, you might wonder, why do I do it? Well, it's a bit of a protest against the taboo that was attached to Marxism, the idea that there was something inappropriate or unacceptable about exploring and making use of the insights of a critical school, critical of capitalism as a system. So in order to sort of show my concern, when the label is applied to me, I don't deny it, I don't brush it away, and I invite people to talk with me about why that is, what I've learned, and why I make that gesture.
So what don't you like about the capitalist society? I mean, you live in the most capitalist society in the world. What don't you like about that society? What's unacceptable?
Well, let me give you an example. A British institution called Oxfam does a report every year, actually twice a year, on inequality in the world. And over the last 50 to 100 years, I think it's fair to say that the dominant economic system globally is capitalism. And the Oxfam report came away with one statistic which I don't think I'll ever forget. And it went this way. The 62 richest people on this planet, most of whom are Americans, not all, but most, together have as much property as the bottom half of the population of the planet, namely 3.5 billion people. That bottom half is, of course, the part of our brothers and sisters who die early, who have diseases that are perfectly curable, that have lives that are difficult, brutish, and probably short, etc., etc. I don't find that an outcome of an economic system that's been dominant for a long time that doesn't invite criticism. Goodness gracious, what other outcome could you imagine that might be better? I think almost anyone listening could manage it. And the second thing, and there are many, but the second one is capitalism is an extraordinarily unstable system. Every 3 to 7 years, it has an economic downturn. We are currently staggering under the impact of the second worst downturn of the capitalist system, the one that happened in 2008, the one before, the 1930s, barely 75 years earlier. This is a system whose inequality and instability would mean that to deny that it has flaws and problems is the burden for someone to justify, rather than the Marxist who says, well, there's a whole critical analysis that explains why that happens and offers alternatives.
But Marxism is an ideology, capitalism is an ideology, and capitalism, supporters would say, it's a rising tide that has lifted all boats. Even the poorest people in the world have become richer because of capitalism, whereas Marxism, well, it may be great in theory, but it's hard to find a place where it's worked.
Well, that that requires you to have the view that it has been applied in a way that makes it a reasonable experiment. My judgment is that it took centuries for the transition from feudalism to capitalism, particularly in Europe, to take place. There were a number of efforts in various cities across Europe to establish what we now look back and call capitalist experiments, if you like. Many of them lasted weeks, months, years. But it took a whole host of conditions to come together to give this system, capitalism, the conditions necessary for it really to gel as a new way of doing things. That seems to me a perfectly reasonable method or a model, if you like, to keep in mind as to how we will get to the next system after capitalism, unless you believe, out of some magical notion, that capitalism is the last stop on this train, since every other system has been born, evolved, and died. I assume that for capitalism, and that the Soviet Union, China, Cuba, Vietnam, those were experiments along the way. They achieved some things. They failed in other areas, and the next experiments that are coming will learn from them in a manner rather replicating how capitalism emerged out of feudalism.
So two very quick questions, and then I'm going to bring David back in. Is the way you believe the world should be, is it the same as communism?
No, not at all, because Marxism is a very large tradition. I mean, think of it this way. Marx dies in 1883, so 150 years, give or take, ago. Since that time, this German emigrant who lived most of his adult life in Great Britain, his work has been percolating across the globe into 1,000 different cultures in 1,000 different conditions, been taken up by people with all kinds of backgrounds and political agendas. To talk about Marxism in a singular way, as if there were one, is crazy. It is a multiplicity of interpretations reflecting its extraordinary growth and spread in the last 150 years. So what you see under the names of communism, socialism, Marxism, and even a host of others are a variety of experiments, some well-intentioned, some not so well-intentioned, that are together going to leave us with the legacy that determines which of these becomes the framework for what will emerge as a new system.
Okay, so if you had to sum up that new system, what you believe in 15 seconds, what would it be?
I think the difference between what people think and where it's going is this. In the past, the notion was that socialism and communism was to give some extraordinary power to the government, to own and operate enterprises, to plan rather than markets. The new direction is that the construction of production, the very work of production, has to be changed from a top-down, non-democratic system of a few people, major shareholders and boards of directors making all the decisions, to the long-delayed democratization of the enterprise. The worker co-op, the cooperation of workers together to produce the goods and services we all need, that's the new direction, and I think that will be what comes to dominate the notion of what socialism means in the 21st century.
That was longer than 15 seconds. David Kuo in Singapore, are you convinced?
No. You won't be surprised, Alex or Richard, that I'm not really sort of convinced about that at all. You see, I am a capitalist, and that doesn't mean I'm greedy, nor does it mean that, you know, I am motivated by accumulating as much wealth as possible. That isn't what capitalism is. Capitalism is just the allocation of capital in such a way that would actually make the use of that capital as efficient as possible. Now, if you take that notion of capitalism, then there is nothing intrinsically wrong with capitalism at all. All it really means is that if I have a dollar, I have to decide how to actually allocate that dollar in order to generate a profit, not a maximum amount of profit, but a profit that would be acceptable to me. Now, you mentioned, you know, those very wealthy people. Eventually, those people will be replaced by others because other people will be better at allocating their capital and they will eventually become the wealthiest people in the world. And there is a possibility that the wealthiest people in the world maybe in the next 20 or 50 years will not be Americans, but they will probably be the people from Asia or Southeast Asia, because they are actually sort of better at allocating the capital that they have, and they will become fabulously wealthy. So when you say that,
the critique is not who is in that position, but the very reality that there can be such a thing as some people with that kind of wealth on the one hand in our culture, in our planet, and a mass of people suffering unspeakable, unnecessary misery.
But no one
on
wants
the other.
That. What is the alternative? How do you allocate that capital unless you give the power to governments, and then, you know, we've tried that, haven't we?
Well, giving the power to the government is not the only option. Suppose we reorganize enterprises. Suppose we actually make the decision of how capital is applied, where investments happen, made democratically by all the people who work in each enterprise, together with the communities they interact with, rather than a tiny number of people who are major shareholders and boards of directors. You know, we pride ourselves in modern culture that we don't have monarchies anymore. We don't allow a few people to make all the political decisions of our lives. Why do we allow a few people to make all the economic ones?
Yeah, but maybe those people at the top are the best people at allocating that capital.
They certainly would like us to believe that, yes.
Well, maybe they are, which is why they are the wealthiest people in the world.
Well, you know, just a personal note.
Yeah,
I'm a product of the elite schools of the United States. I went to Harvard, Stanford, and Yale. I'm like a poster boy. I've spent my entire adult life with those people. To suggest that they are in the position they are because they are cleverer or smarter than everybody else is so far from the mark that I'm left a bit speechless that anyone could actually think it.
But doesn't that put you, I'm sorry, I'm just playing devil's advocate here,
please.
But doesn't that put you into the category that here in London we would call a champagne socialist?
Absolutely. I mean, I've had my share of good luck. I've had my share of opportunity. They tried very hard at each of those institutions to persuade me that capitalism is the best thing since sliced bread, as we like to say here in the United States. They didn't succeed. And the more I watch the capitalist system unfold, the more I see the inequalities of the West replicated in Asia, in India, and in China, or in Latin America and Brazil and so on, the more I see that this is a systemic problem that we have had to kind of suppress here in the United States, and it's been worse here than in Europe, an honest debate about the pros and cons of the system. It's long overdue, and I want to be part of that new generation that is open to criticism of capitalism, because in the end, if you don't criticize a system, then you allow it to indulge its worst tendencies. And the idea of democracy always was to have that kind of criticism. And I think it applies to the way we organize our enterprises every bit as much as it does to any other aspect of our society.
But give me an example of an alternative system that's working.
Well, let me give you an example of the largest worker co-op in the world. It's called the Mondragon Corporation. It's located in the north of Spain. It started 50 years ago by a Catholic priest in the Basque area with six workers. And the priest gave them a little speech. If we wait for capitalists to come here and give us jobs, we will all die of old age before it happens. So let's hire ourselves. Let's set up a co-op. Fast forward to 2016. The Mondragon Corporation is now the seventh largest corporation in all of Spain. It employs roughly 100,000 people in a set of co-ops in every which one, in every of the co-ops that are part of it. The workers together decide what goes on. They hire the managers, not the other way around. The maximum difference between the best paid and lowest paid is a ratio of 8-1. Here in the United States, the CEOs relative to average workers in our large corporations is closer to 350-1. So if you want an example of how radically reorganizing enterprise organization can really do something about stability, about inequality, you have it there in a concrete way, in a Western society over the last 50 years.
Okay, so literally in 15 seconds this time, can you see change happening in your lifetime?
Yes, it is already happening. Again, as an example, being someone who accepts the label Marxist, I now can speak all over the United States in a way that was never possible before. That's not about me. That's about a changed attitude here in this country that says the capitalist system is now so flawed for so many people that it becomes possible and indeed urgent to really begin the debate, and that's where Marxism comes back.
Okay, more shortly. You're listening to the BBC World Service, the world's radio station, and it's a very good morning to our listeners on medium wave in Hong Kong on 675 kilohertz, and also hello to you listening on shortwave in India on 5.97 kilohertz from the BBC's Amman relay station. Let's get a recap of the Business Matters headlines now. Here's Jonathan.
The former president of Switzerland has told the BBC that the UK should try to balance freedom of movement with single market access. Micheline Calmy-Rae also urged the European Union to become more flexible on the issue of immigration or risk exploding. Online accommodation site Airbnb has announced a new policy designed to combat racism among its would-be landlords. The move includes reducing the prominence of photographs and asking users to sign an anti-discrimination agreement. And US aviation regulators have warned passengers not to turn on or charge Samsung Galaxy Note 7 smartphones while on board aircraft. The Federal Aviation Administration also said the handset should not be checked in with luggage either. Samsung recently announced it would recall the 2.5 million phones sent out since they went on sale last month.
Jonathan, thank you. Let's find out what business stories are gripping other parts of the globe now. Australia's solar power generation is set to triple within 2 years, but the government is planning large cuts to the National Renewable Energy Agency. The BBC's Phil Mercer in Sydney. These sound like conflicting objectives, Phil.
That's right. We're looking towards the sun today. Australia has one of the highest per capita rates of greenhouse gas emissions, and climate change and the efforts to mitigate it have long been a very divisive issue in this country. And in the last day or so, we're hearing that 12 new solar power plants will triple Australia's large-scale solar production. And what this means in terms of megawatts is that Australia's solar capacity will increase from 240 megawatts to 720 megawatts. These projects are being subsidised by the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, known by its acronym as ARENA. It could be the last time, though, that ARENA bankrolls these large projects, because the federal government wants to scale back its funding by the tune of $770 million. So the political debate continues, but in the meantime, the head of ARENA, Evel Frischknecht, says that Australia is boosting its position as an international leader.
We're going to be tripling the amount of large-scale solar in Australia. So Australia already leads in terms of solar R&D globally. We have a leadership position in some of the world's main technologies. Every solar panel that's on a roof today, even though they're made in China, they have Australian technology in them. So we lead there. We lead in terms of the rooftop penetration. So Queensland, 30% of households have solar. Australia-wide, it's a little under 20%. So a huge number of people are very familiar with solar.
That's Eva Frischknecht, the chief executive of the Australian Renewable Energy Agency. Phil Mercer still with us. Phil, GDP results this week have helped continue Australia's golden economic run. No recession in 25 years. Constant economic growth. What is Australia's secret as the mining boom comes to an end?
The last time Australia's economy went into reverse was in the middle part of 1991. And since that time, we've had uninterrupted economic growth in this country. And this week, GDP, according to official figures, rose by 3.3%, the best annual result in 4 years. This is, to put this into context, you have to look at it in terms of the continuing fading of Australia's mining boom. And to offset that, the reason, part of the reason why the Australian economy continues to do so well now is that the government has been increasing its spending and investment, essentially providing a crutch to the economy. So the government is welcoming these GDP figures, as you'd imagine, but they do say that there are challenges ahead. Interest rates here are at record lows because of concerns for the longer term health of the Australian economy. But to put these figures into some sort of international context, Australia's economy growing at 3.3%, the American economy growing at just under half of that.
So are there lessons here that Australia can teach the rest of us?
Well, this has been described in the press this week as secret fiscal stimulus for the economy, that the government is quietly funding transport infrastructure and spending big on other investment projects. How long it can sustain this is up for debate, but certainly Australia has to be resilient. Once upon a time, this country relied upon agriculture. In the last 15 years or so, we've had a massive mining boom, largely because of the appetite for iron ore and coal and other natural resources, most notably from China. that demand is fading and Australia once again has to show its adaptability to make sure this incredible run of 25 years of economic growth can continue. As many economists around the world refer to the economy in this part of the world, it is the wonder down under, and many Australians will be hoping that this very impressive record will be continuing.
Of course, this is an average. How evenly is that money that Australia is generating spread around the population?
Well, in recent times, the mining states of Western Australia and Queensland have been leading Australia's economic propulsion, if you like. But of course, as that mining boom continues to fade, those mining states are suffering. So what we have here now is the most populous state in the country is New South Wales. Economic activity here is surpassing that of many other places. Unemployment on the island state of Tasmania, for example, is stubbornly high. So Australia may have a national GDP growth of 3.3%. But of course, as is always the case, there are places that are winners and places that are losers.
The BBC's Phil Mercer in Sydney. Now, ever fancied getting your name into the Guinness World Records? Every year, thousands of people around the world come up with ideas to do just that. This year's edition has just been published, and among the 4,000 entries is that of Marrower the Amazing, who is the Usain Bolt of hula hooping. In June this year in New York, she ran the fastest 100 metres whilst hula hooping. She told me how she did it.
The key to hula hooping is that you have the right size hoop. Everybody stuffs up because they get a small hoop from, like, the pound shop. I can't hoop with one of them. It's way too small.
So these are more expensive?
Exactly. This is an adult-size hula hoop. So you want a hoop that comes up roughly to hip height.
Okay.
That's got a pretty good weight. It's not too light. And then no panicking. Everybody panics and they get in there and they start going like this and they bend their knees and they do some big crazy circles with it. No panicking. You just breathe. You push the hoop into your lower back, you wind it up.
I'm standing back a bit now, so excuse me if you're off mic.
And then you just give it a big push, and then you just push forwards and backwards like this. One, two, three.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
So it's small movement.
Yes, you're hardly moving at all.
Yeah, it's like doing a sit-up. Every time the hoop hits you in the tummy, you push away like that.
Every time it hits you in the tummy, you push away.
Exactly.
Okay.
No knees. If you start moving your knees, it'll just end up on the floor. If you start moving all crazy like this, it's just a very small little movement.
So you're the world record holder.
Yes.
How much do you practice?
A lot. But I'm doing shows all the time, so that's enough practice.
And it's not just the 100 metres you've got.
You've
got other hula hooping records.
I've also been working on the mile, the 100 metres, the 50 metre very short dash. There's talk of a marathon, but I don't know.
Are there other people who you regard as competition?
There's a couple out there, but not too many. I try and just keep on with it and just, yeah.
We've just got a few seconds left. Can you teach me
how to
hula hoop?
Yes, I can. Okay. I don't know. I might need to hold all that for you.
So you could hold the microphone.
I'll hold the mic.
You,
step into the hoop.
Right.
There you go.
Okay.
Okay, you step into it.
Step into it.
Should I take
my jacket off?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Jacket off is definitely going to help.
Jacket off.
Okay, you're going to push it into your lower back.
Push it into my lower back.
Exactly. So hold your hands further back.
Okay, hands
further. Even
back.
Further.
Yeah.
There you go.
Okay,
we might hit the door, so just take one step forward and then wind it up. And then wind it like that,
right.
And then give it a huge push and then forwards and back. Go. Breathe and push. Yes,
it's working. It's working. Fantastic.
Amazing.
I tried to do this so much when I was 7.
Fabulous.
Yeah, the pictures really are better on radio, aren't they? Still have Richard Wolff, professor at the University of Massachusetts, and David Quo at the Motley Fool on the line. And Richard and David, I hope you were very impressed by my efforts there.
Yes, I was, and it reminded me, if you don't mind my saying so, that there's something similar between the twisting and turning of the hula hoop dance and what we're witnessing, or what we have to endure here from our two major candidates as they twist and turn to try to please a population, saying one thing one day, one thing the other. It really is difficult, and you admire their adeptness at doing it.
David, can you help me turn this into a business story in some way?
Well, you know, I think, you know, as far as hula hooping is concerned, what you really need to do is to actually find something that you're good at. Now, I don't know how dexterous you were at hula hooping.
I was very good. You could hear that.
Well, Well, clearly, yes, I could hear it. I couldn't see it, but, you know, I take your word for it. Now, the thing is, I think, you know, what you need to do is to actually sort of find some skills that you are particularly good at. If you enjoy it, then, of course, you know, you will succeed. And whether or not you get a Guinness record for doing what you do is kind of irrelevant. Now, I think of myself as being pretty good at capital allocation. Oh. So, therefore, you know, I just focus on that because I see it as being a core skill that I've developed over the years. Unfortunately, I don't think there is a Guinness record for allocating capital because the best allocator of capital in the world, as most people know, is Warren Buffett, who, as Richard also knows, is one of the wealthiest people in the world.
Can either of you hula hoop? I have to ask.
No. I tried when I was a young person, and I have to admit it did not go well.
Oh. Actually, some other sports news just in. Serena Williams has just been knocked out of the US Open, I'm being told, from next door. So that's not happy news. But back to hula hooping. Other lessons for life and actually record books. Do we need these things? Have you ever come close to getting a world record in anything?
Not me, no. I'm an observer and an admirer, but from a distance.
What would you pick?
As a sport?
If you could be a world record holder in something, what would you pick?
Ping pong.
Ping pong. David?
I think it would have to have something to do with eating because, you know, that is one of my passions in life. So if it was either eating hot dogs or hamburgers or maybe boiled eggs or something, I think I would stand a pretty good chance.
Yes, I've often thought if I opened a restaurant, it would be one of those restaurants where I would make an enormous burger and I would say to anyone who came in that if they could eat the whole burger, then they could have the meal for free. And then I would go away laughing as people thought they could do it, but actually they'd find that I'd put really dry bread and, you know, lots of salad and they would struggle. That would be how I would make my business work and how I would become an extremely rich man. And I hope you'll come to my restaurant one day.
Absolutely.
Of course I would.
Thank you. Thank you. Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts and a Marxist. And David Kuo at the Motley Fool website in Singapore. Thank you for being with us here on Business Matters on the BBC World Service. Plenty more news in the hours ahead. Thank you for listening to this edition of the programme.
There are many ways to keep up with the BBC World Service. Join us on social media or sign up for podcasts at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.